Welcome, everyone, to the Watchmen podcast by Fantastic Geek, your official, unofficial podcast for Watchmen on HBO. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody. Here today with our revisitation of Chapter 2, Absent Friends.
Before we dive on into that, Pete, quick check. Nope, no, Watchmen on HBO still does not have a date. It is still going to be one of those four Sundays in October. Which one will it be? No man can say.
Let us know on Twitter which one you think it will be, which one you want it to be.
Well, Pete, as you said today, we're talking Chapter 2 of the graphic novel. Its summary from the wiki at watchmen.fandom.com is as follows. The opening image, a statue of an angel in a graveyard during the comedian's funeral. Instead of attending Edward Blake's funeral, Laurie visits her mother, Sally Jupiter, Silk Spectre 1, at a retirement home in California. Sally remembers the night the comedian attempted to rape her after the first photo shoot of the Minutemen, the earliest costumed hero organization. Before actually committing rape, Hooded Justice finds the two and attacks the comedian. Back at the funeral, Adrian Veidt, Dan Dreiberg, and Dr. Manhattan witness the comedian's funeral service. Veidt recalls the failed proposal of organizing the Crime Busters, a second costume heroes league. The comedian speaks out to say that such an idea is simply a joke and that in less than 30 years, World War III will commence, a nuclear war. Dr. Manhattan remembers an incident during the end of the Vietnam War. The comedian was visited by a Vietnamese woman whom he had impregnated, and they began to argue. The woman cut the comedian with a broken bottle, leaving a large scar down the right side of his face. The comedian responded by shooting her down. Dr. Manhattan witnessed this without intervening, and the comedian makes note of this. Dan Dreiberg's memory involves his time spent with the comedian during the riots caused by a police strike. Meanwhile, Rorschach visits the retired costume villain Moloch to question him about the comedian's death. Moloch describes the comedian visiting him while drunk late one night, nearly a week before his death. He appears to be worried, fearful, and saddened, mentioning vague activities taking place on an island full of scientists, artists, and writers. After hearing this, Rorschach visits the graveyard and takes a single rose from the comedian's grave. The closing quotation, "And I'm up while the dawn is breaking, even though my heart is aching. I should be drinking a toast to absent friends instead of these comedians." That from The Comedians by Elvis Costello. In the attached document, chapters 3 and 4 of Under the Hood by Hollis Mason, they discuss the formation of the Minutemen. With that, Pete, where would you like to dive on in to Chapter 2?
Really enjoy the funeral and the use of the flashbacks here to really flesh out these characters at a different time in their lives.
Yeah, kind of to use TV parlance, this feels like a mid-season episode, Pete, if such a thing even exists anymore, what with, you know, 13 episode, no 10, no 8, no 6 episode seasons. But, you know, in that longer form storytelling, this feels like somewhere in the middle. Instead, of course, we get it here, Chapter 2. But as you say, Pete, these three, not exactly interwoven flashbacks, but certainly interwoven enough. I'd also like to point out structurally, you know, part of what Watchmen is playing with as a graphic novel is this basic 3x3 9-panel page. And we get that on the first page, but every other panel is either the funeral or Laurie visiting her mother in California. And there's these really great handoffs, you know, at the end of panel one, the mother referring to the retirement home as a city of the dead, but we're coming out of the cemetery itself, a city of the dead, and transitions like that throughout that page. Then on the next page, it's alternating, but it's alternating with a majority in California, not the cemetery, which means, Pete, we have two pages of 9x9, each of which have 9 panels taking place either in the cemetery or in California. That's the attention to detail that Watchmen has.
I remember doing a lot of math in this chapter, particularly with the eras of Edward Blake, the comedian. All right, he's in the 30s, the 40s, now he's in Vietnam, now it's the 80s and he's been killed, just trying to get a grip on the guy's age. Like, he was timeless or something, and, you know, all he was a dude in a suit.
I think you add to that when many of us initially read this. I know certainly for the likes of you and I, we read it in the 90s, which is to say at a point where the contemporary, quote-unquote contemporary 80s, when this takes place, it already was the past. So to kind of stretch back and be like, oh man, the 1970s, oh man, Vietnam, that was kind of ancient history. It's kind of similar to Back to the Future, where it's like, oh man, traveling from the 80s to the 50s, so incredibly far. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh no, it's 2015, and now we're all aging terribly. And maybe that's the point of this chapter, Pete, that we all age terribly. I don't know. But yeah, a lot of time jumping going on here. And for what is otherwise not a slow in terms of boring story, but a fairly, you know, fairly kind of well planned out presentation here, you need to kind of pedal quickly to keep track of the different eras that Blake is in.
It's such an important chapter, in particular, the pathos behind Edward Blake. You know, you mentioned where we ended, that he's gone to a mortal enemy in Moloch, that there's some kind of, you know, gentleman's agreement with, you know, you're the bad guy, I'm the good guy, not a very good guy. And, you know, we're gonna have this simpatico. Before that, the disclosure of what happened in Vietnam and the signs of Dr. Manhattan checking out, that he did nothing when Blake gunned that pregnant woman down, and he's shamed for it by the murderer.
He is, and I mean, so many layers there in that scene that you're describing. One, obviously, for story potential moving forward for the rest of the book, it's calling attention to the fact that Dr. Manhattan can be taken out of the equation sometimes, and how one does that exactly is obviously up for some debate, particularly if you're like, oh, I don't know, Adrian Veidt. But there's that. Then you add to it, you know, Blake blaming somebody else for not having stopped Blake's behavior, something that we'll circle back to in another scene of Blake's behavior, to say the least, in a little bit. Then you could even go completely kind of metaphorical to the degree that this is America and perhaps other Western countries coming on in, doing what they want to do in Vietnam, and then, hey, no responsibility, time to leave, as we see with his treatment here of this woman.
Yeah. And then the flashback of the cops strike and the brutality and the, you know, we can do whatever we want mentality of Blake, you know, contrast with Night Owl 2, who believes in the rule of law.
It's sad, but telling, and ultimately benefiting the novel here, how many contemporary issues are present in this particular chapter. Certainly, as you say, Pete, rule of law versus, you know, will of the majority, that sort of thing. Certainly some of the gender politics that I think we'll get into in a moment. I'll just add, I suppose, by way of transition, and I know we've mentioned this idea before, but the level of detail in here, particularly, you know, this kind of pre-digital, you know, like on my expensive artist pad, let me draw something that's super, super, super detailed, even if it's only going to be printed half a page. I think of that as we flash back with Veidt into the Crime Busters meeting. Not only do we have all this dialogue to deal with, not only do we have details like the headline there about the French pulling out of Vietnam and whatnot. Not only do we have to navigate Captain Metropolis's kind of halting presentation here, you know, third, I guess you should call me by my first name, that kind of, you know, weak presentation there. But you also have Dr. Manhattan looking over at the young Laurie, which of course is setting up things later in the chapter and of course later in the book.
You know, we talk when we look at these because it's unavoidable in light of the 2009 film and that they chose not to include Captain Metropolis and what that does as far as this scene is concerned. And then the detail of the map that Blake burns with the different parts of the country and what's going on there. You know, you've got promiscuity, Matt, happening up there in the Pacific Northwest, drugs in California, anti-war. I can't quite.
I think that's demos, short for
demos. Yes, yeah. In the center of the country, black unrest in Georgia, in the Panhandle there, and the way that this is kind of framed, that the things that led to the civil rights revolution are essentially pushed back on themselves. Like, you know, we need to solve these things.
Well, and particularly with this attitude that I think, you know, clearly is being espoused by Captain Metropolis. Side note, Pete, my goodness, Captain Metropolis, who's he meant to be a stand-in for, you know, if not kind of a weak-willed Superman? I know we have Dr. Manhattan as the Superman analogy, but I think that this is kind of this is kind of Captain Metropolis as powerless Clark Kent saying, gee whiz, guys, if only we just investigate a little further. Hey, breaking news, it's 1970 right on those. I found the four problems for what's going on in America. It's promiscuity, anti-war demonstrations, drugs, and black unrest. If only we could solve these four problems, then everything can be dealt with. You know, there's kind of this staggering level of naivete.
Unrest is how they would have said it in the South. So you pronounced it properly the first time.
Pete, in preparing to reread, particularly this chapter, I was concerned, how is this book written by two men, or authored, I suppose is the best way to put it, authored by two men in the 1980s, particularly this chapter that deals with the attempted rape of Sally Jupiter. I had these concerns, you know, is any of this not going to have aged well in terms of, you know, perhaps a better understanding post-Me Too movement, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, when this was written as today, this rape scene is, you know, not glorified, not sizzling. It's meant to be as disgusting as it is. And I was a little relieved that the book still appeared that way. I mean, it helps, of course, to have the comedian just be, by and large, the villain of this chapter. But I thought that certainly the message of the comedian's brutality in these two pages, that came across sharply.
And I mentioned in our last podcast, you know, having taught this on the high school level in the Me Too era and examining this particular chapter through that lens, you know, obviously you're dealing with high school kids. I had sophomores and then I had seniors. And, you know, approaching the Tijuana Bible, you know, you don't want to draw too much attention to things, obviously, that may have been missed, and not, hey, kids, let's look at this particular panel on this page. But to get the general idea thematically, and, you know, this strange place that Sally Jupiter is in, reliving what becomes the fragrance name later on, nostalgia, that it's all about, you know, looking back and this idea that things were better and this horrible chapter she went through. And then the message to her daughter that, you know, things are tough all over, cupcake, and it rains on the just and the unjust alike, except in California. Boom, back to that funeral there. And it's a really interesting, complicated presentation. It would have been so simple to say a rape was attempted on this character. She fought it off. She was saved. She is bitter towards the comedian. No, she remembers the guy fondly. And we're like, what is the deal between them? What happened? And they're setting us up, but we don't fully realize what we've been set up for.
Yeah, and I think that nugget that you've just hit on, that's part of what I think makes this have aged so well, in that we are not meant to understand, whether it's kind of objectively or through the lens of gender, through the lens of age, whatever it might be, we're not meant to understand her sense of nostalgia here. We're meant to be sickened by these very frank pages where it's not just the attack itself and some of it off screen, or some of the, you know, no Eddie, don't, oh God, that kind of thing. A lot of blood in these pages too, Sally's bleeding from the face a lot after Hooded Justice comes in and bloodies the comedian's nose. He's got a lot of blood on his face as well. And then you add to it, there's kind of the little tease here, the comedian saying to Hooded Justice, oh, is this what gets you hot? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Certainly tying up to the attached document at the end, where there's the very light suggestion here that it is the comedian who killed Hooded Justice in response for this. But then I feel like almost in a disappointing, deflating icing on the cake, you have the attack, the end of it with Hooded Justice, the comedian kicked out, all in two opposing pages, 18 panels there. Then you turn the page and you get one more in the past, where Hooded Justice says to Sally, get up and for God's sake, cover yourself. This implication that she did something to cause this, which we know is not the case, but that's what Hooded Justice certainly is pushing there.
Yeah, the masochism of this scene in particular, when it comes to Blake and the beating that he takes at the hand of Hooded Justice. And like you said, kind of spurring him on, the sexual overtones of it. Again, simple, but at the same time, very, very layered, and just a well-constructed chapter, the way it weaves these stories in. And for us to conclude, it's weird enough that Rorschach winds up in Moloch's apartment and
in his fridge, man.
In his fridge to find out what had gone on between him and Blake. Then the cancer thing thrown in there for this added air of mystery. And then it's terminal, that he's going to wind up, for the most part, because really, who believes Rorschach? Dryberg is underground. He's not really somebody who's going to associate with him at this point out in the open. So whatever shared between them, this man is dying. He's going to take it to the grave. And then to get the joke in the journal at the end. And I just want to point out, on the burlesque show on the marquee there, Enola Gay and the Little Boys, somebody's got to use that as a band name if they haven't already.
To circle back to Moloch's cancer for a second, I don't know if the two sentences I want to highlight here, I don't know if they came from inspiration from somewhere else, or if this, was a brand new original turn of phrase from Alan Moore's pen, typewriter, quill. I don't know. Does he write with kind of just a stick in the dirt and takes pictures? I don't know. But this line here, the kind of cancer that you eventually get better from, well, that ain't the kind of cancer I got. There's just so much is said in those two sentences. It's a sad whimsy. It's a fatalism, obviously. There's just so much emotion in those combinations of words put together to kind of have a setup and a punchline, but none of it is funny and none of it is none of it is positive or, you know, hold your head high against adversity. There's kind of none of that there. And it's just such a, it's a line that always has struck me with such weight, even though it's delivered with a little bit of a sad wink, at least coming from Moloch. I don't think it's a wink to the audience, but it's him trying to put some kind of happiness there where there is none.
Oh, undoubtedly. And by the end of the funeral and the comic portion, this sad, tragic, pathetic thing, you know, how many times do we see Blake bloodied in this chapter? Hooded Justice, the woman in Vietnam, the beating at the hands of who we'll eventually learn is Adrian Veidt that resulted in his death. And who's there in the graveyard? It's Rorschach.
Yeah, kind of in a melancholy ending there, and one in which, you know, Pete, I don't quite know what etiquette and protocol would call for, but I suspect hours after the funeral, one should not be nicking a rose off the grave there. I'll add, I guess, as we have gotten to the end of this chapter here, I'll just add that I feel that the two chapters from Under the Hood that we get at the end of this chapter of Watchmen, these two are better for me. I think just in part because we're actually into the hero stuff and it ties perhaps a bit better into the story we just read. But it just, again, it comes across as so authentic, so lived in, so real. And to tie it back to the show for a second, it makes me hope, again, there's some sort of meta-narrative that the show does, you know, whether it's the, you know, more of this book being printed or print the whole darn thing, or, you know, the YouTube channel that's talking about, that's like some quote-unquote homemade history of Hollis Mason made by HBO, you know, whatever it is, just something that adds to that lived-in feeling. You know, I think back to like the Oceanic Airlines website from Lost, which ended up not really being a thing, you know, it didn't really tie into the show. It didn't really give insight, but you'd go there and go, this feels so real.
Yeah, I think there remains an opportunity with stories like Lost, with stories like Watchmen, again, the attached documents, the supplemental materials, whatever it's going to be. For me, in the Under the Hood, in the third chapter, in this chapter, the thing that stands out is the story of Dollar Bill, man. And again, that really well done credit sequence from the 2009 film. All you need to do is see the dude entangled in the revolving door, shot to death, to know this is not a normal superhero story. And nice guy, tried to do the right thing, wore a friggin' cape, shot dead. And this is not going to go the way that you think it's going to go, the way this whole chapter just completely baffles you in terms of the superhero experience. And let's be honest, 85, 86, you know, we were past the golden and silver ages, and now we're into this completely different era of comic books, of graphic novels, and this is being published. And, you know, looking back at those eras and mining them again for nostalgia, you know, you can't tell the story of the Minutemen without Batman and Superman and Captain America and, you know, all those heroes. But, you know, Mothman losing his marbles, and the subtext again comes up in the third chapter there about sexual hangups, and Night Owl 1, Hollis Mason writing about that. But it's for me embodied in the Dollar Bill story.
I mean, it's we can see in the rearview mirror what the modern age of comics has looked like since 1986, but you're right to kind of rewind and say, you know, January 1986, things were normal. Then February, that's when The Dark Knight Returns number one comes out. Then that has its run. Fast forward to September of that year, that's when Watchmen first starts to come out. And what it must have been like to be like, oh man, the craziest thing I ever read was, must have been Crisis of the Infinite Earths. And then now you just have this, particularly in this issue, chapter two, you know, just time hopping, but in a way that's not, you know, goofy, you know, some sort of goofy machine. It's just through flashbacks. You have a funeral, you have sexual assault, you have civil unrest, you have people being bloodied, you have, you know, kind of a return to the comedian being killed for the second issue in a row and things of that sort. And it's just, it must have been such a break from what was normally, you know, being read at the time.
Well, from the Watchmen to the Minutemen to the Avengers, Matt, we're running a little bit of a raffle.
Indeed we are, Pete. As listeners leave us reviews on Apple Podcasts for the whole family of podcasts, running a little, as you say, raffle, Pete. Each review is going to get thrown in the old hopper, along with some other ways to get your name in the hopper as well. And then the winner is going to receive themselves a digital download to get their very own digital copy of Avengers Endgame.
Yes, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can share our status on Facebook. You can retweet us on Twitter. And if you are a patron on patreon.com/fantasticgeek and you do any or all of those things, you're going to automatically get double entries.
So exciting stuff there, and an opportunity to help get the word out about Fantastic Geek, particularly, Pete, as we start to wrap the summer up, as we start to look ahead to some of the new territory, the new shows that we'll be podcasting, etc. Certainly top of the list, at least on this Watchmen Wednesday, Pete, as we look ahead to Watchmen on HBO.
Watchmen, Got Your God Friend in Me, Season 2. We'll be bringing you Star Wars The Mandalorian, the signature piece of content coming out of Disney Plus out of the gate on November 12th. And of course, we'll be there to bring it to you. Star Trek Picard, all that good stuff. And of course, every single show and film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Wouldn't want to leave any of that behind, Pete. And how can people be in touch to maybe share that they have left a review, maybe talk Watchmen? Bottom line, Pete, how can people be in touch with you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, PIETERJKETELAR, KETELAAR, 10,617 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter's Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast. Comment on FantasticGeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Gmail, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with the PH, all one word, like it today.
Well, Pete, I look forward to talking about Chapter 3 of Watchmen in the near future, of course, as we get even closer to the series happening. And with that, Pete, I will say honk honk to all our listeners and give you the final word.
Good joke. Everybody laugh. Roll on snare drum. Curtains.